Welcome, everybody, to session 376, Navigating and Strengthening a Mixed Faith Marriage. So this is the closing evening session. Following this session, there will be a Linger Longer picnic with music by the Angela Sophie Band. Okay. Following the music, there will be evening storytelling with Robert Kirby, Gina Colvin, and Courtney Clark Kendrick. Tickets are limited. It's not free. Available for purchase at the registration desk. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Everyone take a moment to silence your cell phones so that we can minimize alerts and distractions. As you leave us tonight, we want to thank you all for coming and being part of this Sunstone Symposium. You have now participated in a tradition of Mormon history that is over 40 years old. Mormonism can be what we make it, and your participation helps make Mormonism a little more diverse, interesting, and inclusive. Regardless of your relationship with the Restoration, we claim you as an important part of this community. You are wanted, your voice is needed. You claiming the identity in your own way is an act of resistance against hate, division, and intolerance. Thank you for having the courage to show up and engage at Sunstone. Feel free to make a donation to Sunstone and attend the next regional conference in Glasgow, Scotland, if you so desire, on September 1st. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within that framework so that folks can get out for dinner on time. Okay, the abstract for this session is, as more Mormons experience faith transitions and faith awakenings, many couples find themselves unexpectedly in mixed faith marriages. This session presents both personal and professional insights into honoring both the challenges and benefits of differing beliefs in a marriage. We will highlight the gifts associated with individualization and fostering mutual respect for each person's spiritual journey. We will offer suggestions for reducing conflict, improving communication, and strengthening a couple's emotional connection and intimacy. Okay, I'm going to introduce our three panelists. I'm going to let Sarah say her own last name so I don't butcher it. Sarah Hughes Zabawa, who is right here on audience left, is a licensed clinical social worker, wellness coach, and yoga instructor who specializes in treating trauma, depression, and anxiety. She often works with LGBTQ+ individuals and their families to foster acceptance and advocacy skills, as well as individuals and couples experiencing life transitions related to their faith. I'm going to go next to Jana Spangler, who is an integral professional coach. Okay. She works with Symmetry Solutions, specializing in faith transitions and their impact on identity, relationships, and spirituality. She is a student at the Living School under the direction of Friar Richard Rohr, OFM. I don't know what, that's something of
it's
Franciscan.
Yeah. Franciscan order.
Studying contemplative wisdom traditions. And last but not least, Anthony D. Miller, MBA, MSF, FS, and CFP, is a business owner and education enthusiast. He traversed a faith crisis that began after stumbling across the LDS Church History Gospel Topics essays while searching for resources to support his adult gay son. Anthony frequently contributes to online support groups about faith transition, and he blogs at unpackingambiguity.com. And so I'm going to turn the time over to you folks.
So we thought we'd start with a little bit of an introduction. This is my family. That's me 20 pounds ago. And next to me is my son's partner, Jaden. and then my wife, Susan, and my daughter, Rachel. She's a junior studying ballet at Utah Valley University, and she's an active believing member. And then my son, Nelson, he's 25 years old and just finished a master's degree in computer science last year, and he and his partner live in Logan in a house that they have. I grew up in the church. My parents joined the church when I was 3, and all my ancestors were Mennonite. And so it was quite a liberalization to become Mormon for my parents. If I hadn't had joined the church, I probably would have followed a family tradition and become a Mennonite minister or pastor. And in my family history, I have entrepreneurs, educators, and ministers. So it kind of was in my DNA. Growing up in the Mesa, Arizona area, my family was super Orthodox. For family home evening, we would read Bruce R. McConkie's Mormon Doctrine. As a youth, my parents sent me to Cleon Skousen workshops, super, super black and white Orthodox. I served a mission in Barcelona, Spain, and got a degree in Spanish and then a master's in business and moved to Billings, Montana, where I had all sorts of great opportunities in the church to grow. And I served for years as a gospel doctrine teacher and on the high council and a high priest group leadership and as a high priest group leader. And my plan was to sell my business when I turned about 60 and serve missions with my wife for the rest of my life. And 2 years ago, 27 months ago, my wife and I were on the verge of becoming empty nesters so that we could become ordinance workers together. I had spent a total of about 4 years as an ordinance worker. And I had many spiritual experiences that helped me grow and community and reputation. And when our son came out, I went online and I searched and I found the Gospel Topics essays and Mormon Think and the CES letter and Mormon Stories and the Fair Mormon Table of Contents all in one weekend, and experienced in a very acute existential faith crisis when I came to the conclusion that my past spiritual experiences had witnessed of things that were inaccurate. And it was extremely painful and went through very difficult stages of grief, anger, and depression, and loss of reputation and identity and community and purpose, and even for a period, loss of God and spirituality. My wife continues as, I'm no longer a member of the church as of January of this year. The choice that I needed to have peace in my life. My wife continues as a member of the church. She's the first counselor in the Stake Relief Society presidency, and she is an ordinance worker. And somehow through all this, we were able to navigate a mixed faith marriage. And when we experience fear, it's because we were about the future. But when we focus on the present, we have our struggles, but we have a very meaningful marriage, and I hope to share some of those things today. So that's a little bit about me and where I'm coming from.
Next. Am I next? Yes. Okay, this is like the only picture we could find of the whole family. I'm a terrible picture taker. I think always think later, oh, shoot, I should have taken some pictures. But hopefully that just means I'm enjoying the moment, right? So this is my husband, Robin. You can see the live version if you look right over here. And we've been married for, it'll be 20 years this year, in November. Our daughter, Avery, who's now 14, and our sons, Jude and Joel, they're 12 and 10. So I was born and raised in the church. I'll just try to make this brief. I don't even know what I'm wanting to share here. But born and raised in the church, I think I've always been a fairly... I was not a real black and white thinker. I've always had some nuance to me, and but I think my core beliefs were fairly literal. And we were married in the temple. You know, I've always done the church thing, and I've always held it in a way where I really felt compelled to be part of it because I really wanted to be good. That's kind of the core of my personality. And I really, and to this day, want to be good. And that was my framework for how I do that. So I did have a lot of internal pressure to have it to look and be good in the way that I understood the map to be. About 4 years ago, I think I had started having some cognitive dissonance for some time, but it was mostly around feeling a lot of expansion around ideas and spirituality and thought leaders that were outside of the church. They didn't really, I never had a quandary with that because it didn't disagree with the gospel. But it felt more soul expanding in a way that I didn't understand, and it caused me a problem. That led to a crash of my shelf. And I think Rob and I would both say we're not the best example. We've always had struggles in our marriage, as everyone does, but I feel like we've struggled a lot for a lot of our marriage. Strangely, the faith crisis, I feel like we've handled it better than the rest of our marriage. it's actually been pretty good. And I'll talk as we go through this some of the gifts that have made that to be so for us. But I am still actively attending church. Carrie Temple recommend. And it's, turn your mess into your message. I became a life coach to help people through faith crisis and help people in mixed faith marriage. This is an example of, this whole thing is an example of do as I say, not as I do.
Amen.
And I will just say that for me, what it highlights is that, the neural research shows that new neural pathways are created not from new knowledge, not from understanding something, it's from doing it. And I could use a lot of work in a lot of the things. I feel like I have to say that with my husband sitting there. I can imagine him looking at this presentation going, yeah, that'd be good if you did that. But, that's how we rewire the brain into new action, is by actually doing it. And then that will cement what we already know. So I say that, I offer that to say that, we'll have this presentation, and then, you'll say, I have all these good ideas, and you'll go back and go, this is super hard. That's normal. Like, it's okay. It's a step. It's a step to open up to new ideas.
Thanks, Jenna. I'm Sarah Hughes Abawa, and I have my whole family right here. So this is my husband, Matthew, and our 3-year-old son, Noah, and our brand new baby girl, Daisy. Matthew and I we met at BYU, which I didn't want to go to, but ended up there somehow. Met Matt there. We were married in the temple. The funny thing about Matt and I is we're complete opposites in every other category of our life. So we sit with a lot of differences in both our hobbies, our interest in music, our politics, and at the core, we just really loved each other. And so it was interesting that when there was the one commonality of the church and a relationship to the institution, when I began to really struggle and no longer feel safe or trust the institution in my own personal life or in my work as a therapist with our LGBTQ youth, my faith crisis showed up in a very real way and really challenged our marriage. Like many of us, we got married really young and hadn't experienced healthy differentiation until the faith crisis really invited that in a unique way, and so we'll talk more about that. Matt and I still have to work really closely on learning how to compromise where we are spiritually. Our spiritual needs are very different, we've learned, and what helps us spiritually thrive are different, and we continue to do this dance and to walk this really tender walk. So if you're here and find yourself there, I just want you to know you're not alone, and I join you as a place of equal. I can talk about this from a professional, but at the same time, I talk about this as someone who doesn't have all the answers and still continually struggles, finds grace, and then struggles again. We want to just create a space, like I said, the struggle is real. We want to honor that a mixed faith marriage can create some of the most tender and wounding moments and conversations of a marriage. And so if this is tender for you, I just want you to know we realize that. without as much sincerity as possible. We want to honor everyone in this space, regardless of where you find yourself on the belief spectrum. We might have active believing members here. We might have individuals who have chosen that the church is no longer emotionally safe, and I want you to make sure that we're coming at this as a level of respect, because in a partnership, respect and seeing and honoring each other's unique differences is the core of how we're going to help this relationship thrive. So we want to make some safety there. We want to honor the wounds and loss of both parties involved. Oftentimes in spaces like this, we talk about the individual who's had a faith awakening or faith crisis and just support them. Both individuals' experiences are of value, and there is wounding and loss on both ends of that relationship. So we want to just honor that. Really being vulnerable here, getting professional help is often proactive, supported, and at times necessary. I sit in front of you as a mental health professional with all of those skills who had to go to a mental health professional to have some of the hardest conversations with my partner about next steps and how to honor where we were in our differences. So I want to validate that we might provide some general suggestions and tips today, but if that's still not working, professional help makes a lot of sense and is oftentimes necessary, and there's no shame in that. So first and foremost, this is going to be hard for some of us, spoiler alert, we are all in mixed faith marriages. Just sit with that for a moment. We are all in mixed faith marriages. Spirituality is a deeply personal practice. So even though Matthew and I were married in the temple, we went into that experience as completely different, separate people, with the things that make us spiritually thrive, the things that enlivened our heart, right? Spirituality at its core is deeply personal, which is why it's so interesting that I can't say, just believe this, right? Like if I said, Jenna, just believe this, just do it. Right? It doesn't work like that. We are unique individuals and go into our spirituality with unique different needs and expectations. So I just want to ask you guys, why is this so hard for individuals with a Mormon construct to grasp?
So my comment on that is that in a lot of faith traditions, there's not a lay clergy. And so you go and you listen to a sermon, and not everyone has to follow the same formula or believe or say the same thing or have the same experience in those kinds of situations. And so if we were in an evangelical Christian situation and I was sitting with my wife, we could have very different experiences and interpretations, and it wouldn't be quite as painful. But in the culture and organization of Mormonism, what we have is we have a construct where there's not as much differentiation, and so it tends to be a little bit more difficult, because we're all expected that if we follow this formula, we're going to have the same experience, right? If I read this, I'm going to feel this way, and that's the case. And if you're not having spiritual experiences the same as mine, it's because you're not following the formula or something. We all bear the same testimony. We all teach from the same manual. And so as a result, when we begin to experience differentiation beyond a certain level in a faith area, it becomes way more painful, because we're not used to that. We're not used to having conversations that, you know, with our kids to say, well, mom interprets information this way and dad does this way, and it's okay that they have different opinions, you know, about matters of faith, right? And so that can be very, very difficult.
Yeah, and I would just add that it around matters of spirituality, we don't always think, when we're kind of the same and we go to church and we all kind of just assume everyone takes in Mormonism the same way that we do. And we don't always have the deep conversations about that until we absolutely have to. And so I see it quite often where you know, someone who is going through the faith crisis or whatever is telling their spouse how they feel about the church and projecting the ideas of the church onto that person when it was really how they internalized it. And the spouse is going, wait a minute, no, that's not how I feel. I don't feel that way, but this person did. And what that highlights is that maybe one person is interpreting things differently, but we don't have deep enough conversations while we have the same faith we don't have the deep enough conversations to really understand how our partner is internalizing that.
Another cultural thing, we see individuals getting married incredibly young. I was 21 when I got married. My prefrontal cortex wasn't even developed, right? That doesn't develop until you're 27, when it becomes like what you're deeply passionate about, what you're really interested in, like who you are as a person doesn't really start formulating until much later. So in some ways, that was really daring that we got married so young when I still didn't know fully who I was going to be, and I'm still in that journey as well. But a part of that is when we get married so young, we don't really practice this differentiation where individuals in their 30s or 40s who come together married know pretty clearly like what they believe, who they are, what they're passionate about, right? And there's some beauty in getting married young and learning together, but we do not practice often recognizing and celebrating the differences of ourselves because we're spending more of our time nurturing a relationship with someone else than our individual sense of who we are.
So some examples of differentiation that eventually aren't really painful. One example is the five love languages. If you've heard of the five love languages by Dr. Gary Chapman, he talks about how people express and receive emotional intimacy. And my primary love language is physical touch. So if my wife holds me as I'm waking up in the morning, that's like golden. And words of affirmation. So if she expresses kind and encouraging words to me, that's what love is. And for my wife, her primary love language is quality time, doing together activities, and acts of service, which to me, that's like Greek, because I delegate tasks all day. I don't understand how that could possibly be love, but that's what love is to her, right? So obviously there's pain before we realize that, and we learn to become fluent in each other's love language. But once we do that, it's not that painful to have that differentiation. I don't go, oh, I feel so much pain that my wife's primary love language is quality time, right? So that kind of differentiation isn't painful, right? But there's different kinds of spiritual beliefs and things that we hold that can be extraordinarily painful when the differentiation happens.
So just a note on autonomy and authenticity. As people go through their own faith changes, this becomes very important. I've found it pretty universally, where people are really attaching to their own authority because they feel like they have given that away for so long, and they really are trying to internalize why they're doing what they're doing. And when you're married, this can really bring up the differentiation thing and the need for differentiation, because someone can be saying, you know, I no longer want to wear my garments. I'm not comfortable with that. And the believing spouse, that is going to have some large repercussions to many people. And then you have this tension. You've got this tension between someone wanting to be who they are versus how do we honor. You know, we made a promise when we were married, and this is what this is symbolizing to me. So one thing I like to help people understand is that not only do you have your own individual authenticity, you have a systemic authenticity to the marriage. You know, I think a beautiful example of this is Tova Mirbus, who's a woman who left Orthodox Judaism. And one of the most beautiful things that I think she did along her journey is to decide to keep an Orthodox kitchen, which a kosher kitchen, which is just not easy. It's not an easy thing, but she did that so that the people that she loves will feel comfortable in her home. That is certainly not probably authentic to her, but it is gracious, and it is authentic to the systemic the system and the systemic authenticity that she wants to create with the people she loves. So I like to remind people of that.
And that can look like going to sacrament meeting with your spouse as a form of support, as long as that is not wounding and mentally unhealthy. And then making, like, it's the compromises, right? And so that's going to look very different in your relationships and uniquely, but recognize that you are not unauthentic. You are not going against who you are by also trying to figure out ways to honor the system in which you have inhabited, like your family. So there's no right or wrong way to do that. That's so individual to the couple, just like the Orthodox kitchen. I just want you to think that you are not being untrue to yourself. And I think sometimes when we're going through a faith transition, we're like, I'm going to be true to myself and beyond anything else. But we also have to remind who we are in the context of our loved ones and our families. So research, real quick, Anthony. So research beyond faith crisis, like differentiation in couples is a huge part of marital therapy. The three most common skills associated with navigating differentiation effectively are patience, curiosity, and a willingness to tolerate tension. I don't know about you, but none of those three were taught in my Mormon primer. No one taught me how to just be incredibly patient with my partner's choices if I disagree with them. No one talked to me to get really, really curious without being defensive about spiritual differences. We come from a proselyting narrative where we tell other people our testimony, right? This is what I believe. This is how I believe. This is how you should believe. Yeah, no lessons on listening. Thank you for that. Also, a willingness to tolerate tension. We struggle culturally with being able to sit in difference. I don't know if you ever had someone in one of your Sunday school classes raise their hand and disagree on something and see how the whole church doesn't know quite how to do that. Because contention is of the devil. We have a lot of narratives about just peace and love, and while those are definitely important values, so is recognizing that tension is where we can learn. And oftentimes tension, how we handle tension, is how we show other people our love and respect for them. We just want the tension to go away. We want to fix it. That is not going to work in a mixed faith marriage that all of us find ourselves in. The common emotions that surface are fear. Anger oftentimes shows up, but it's a secondary emotion. So when people say, I'm really angry, I'm so angry at the church, I'm so angry at you for loving the church, or I'm so angry at you for leaving the church, their anger is real, but it's most deeply tied to fear. Fear of I'm going to lose you, fear of disconnection. This is an evolutionary process in the body. We are hardwired to be connected, and when we fear disconnection, there's an evolutionary response that says you got to fight that or fix that, fight or flight, right? Because if we were disconnected from our tribe, we could die. This was an internal survival mechanism. So when fear shows up, it's not even sometimes conscious. It's not even like we're choosing this. Like, it's evolutionary. It's based in our bodies. Betrayal, shame, and multiple grief cycles. Grief is cyclical, you guys. We step into it 100 times. And that's denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance.
So a faith crisis really is also an identity and a relationship crisis. And these are things that are extremely painful. And questions that are typically asked, and we kind of have this on either side of the equation. If you are the one who is more in faith transition, you are going to be asking questions of yourself, like, who am I? Where do I belong? Who can I trust? How am I perceived? You have all these new existential questions of life and death, since your narrative has kind of, you know, been, the rug has been pulled out from under you. And at the core of it, will I still be loved? If you're in a marriage, like, will I still be accepted and loved? Or are they going to see me as something lesser than? Very common. And on the flip side, like, as we said, this is extremely painful for both parties. The person who is believing is wondering, who are you? Who are you? Who is it? You are not, this is not who I married. Who are you? What does this mean for our family and our eternal marriage? What effect will this have on our children? What does this mean for our standing in the community? And how are we going to relate to one another? This is how we related. How is this going to happen? That's a lot of fear and a lot of pain.
So when I was in the dark night of the soul, I reached out to my leaders because they're my friends, right? And they didn't have satisfying answers because their role is not to be an apologist. They have pastoral callings. And my good friend, who was my stake president, had this amazing allegory or metaphor for me. He says, I want you to imagine that you spent your whole life, I was 49 years old at the time, you spent your whole life building this amazing 1,000-piece puzzle that had been totally prescribed to you, and it was perfect, and it worked for you. And somehow, through no fault of your own, it just got thrown onto the floor, and it's all there in broken pieces. He said, so what you're going to do now is you're going to pick up one piece at a time, and you're going to look at it, and you're going to see if that works for you. And if it does, you'll put it back on your table. And if it doesn't, you'll set it aside. And incrementally, you'll add more pieces to the table until you will build a new puzzle. And it will be smaller than before, but it'll mean more because you will have built it. And I thought that was an amazing allegory and very helpful, but super overwhelming when he told it to me, because, like, I can't even pick up one of the pieces on the floor, right? But the allegory works also for the relationship, because we had this ideal or vision of what things were going to happen in the future, and it was all prescribed for us, and we usually probably pretty much agreed on what it was going to look like, and it got crashed to the floor. And so it takes time and trust and with some pain to pick up those pieces and to build something new. But we can do it.
Healthy boundaries. Most of us probably did this the wrong way, and so this is how we learned this. So just some humility there. Recognize your loved one might not be able to hold your grief, especially your anger. We need safe spaces to vent, and Anthony has a really good example of some boundaries that were created for him.
So when I was in the anger and depression stages of deconstruction, and I would read something and I would need to talk to my person, my wife, because I trusted her, right? And so I would deconstruct and I would vent with her about the things that I was finding, but it was wounding for her. And she felt like she needed to be there for me because she was my person, but it was damaging our relationship. And my wife's an amazing human being. You would recognize it when you meet her. And she said to me early on, she says, I know you're hurting, and I know you're in pain, and I know you need to vent and process these things, but it can't be with me. So I want you to go find places that you can vent, places that you can process, whether it's online groups or in-person groups or a therapist or whatever it is, go and do that so that when you're with me, you can be with me and be present with me and not wound me, so that we can grow and build together. And I was like, how do you even do that? Like, I kind of, she's so nuanced and amazing, but I'm so grateful that it was me that went through this and not her, because I don't know that I would have had that capacity to give her the same space that she gave me in that healthy boundary.
Another reminder is watch to displace anger or projection. Remember, your partner is not the institution or its history. I really wish I would have had this bulleted point, like, hanging on my fridge. Right? Like, when we are really hurting, especially about aspects of church history that are wounding or defy our understanding of a loving entity, oftentimes there's so much betrayal in that that we didn't express that to someone, and we usually go to our people who are our safest, but then we wound the people who are our safest, right? And so we just need to make sure, like, even if you have a loved one who really finds incredible spiritual wellness within the church, they are not the church itself. And I think sometimes, once again, we have a hard time differentiating that someone can have a beautiful relationship with the church and not believe in, not agree with everything, or they are not the ones making the decisions. That is a really, really hard place to be. Same flip side, when a spouse recognizes they're going to rage against the CES letter, they're going to rage against the essays, or they're going to rage against the podcast you listen to, right? Like, you are not them, right? I would agree.
Oftentimes, you know, when there's talk against the church and then the person feels attacked because they identify with the church. So both partners need to remember that they're not the institution.
That is so healthy. So just for the recording, the suggestion was that both parties need to remember they're not the institution and aren't in a place that have to explain, justify, or become defensive about that, right? That's so wise. Thank you for that. Boundaries at its core is what it is and what is and what is not okay with you. So when you think about like what a boundary is, sometimes that's internal. We have three types of boundaries. We can have boundaries within ourselves when you hear something and you're like, nope, that doesn't work for me. Spoken boundaries is when you have to speak your truth and create a healthy boundary. And then boundaries regarding actions, like removing yourself from the situations. Boundaries of I will no longer attend. Boundaries of, so it's an action behavior, right? So spoken, internal, and action.
Yeah, this is just really sticky. In mixed faith marriage, I'm just going to say this really in any marriage, but this particular point in a marriage can bring on such a need for deeper negotiation skills than we have ever had in our lives. And it is what makes it really, really difficult is because there's so much pain on both sides. It is really hard to do what we need to do, which is really care about the other person. And make sure that, and it's this balance between the tension of helping my spouse and feeling like I need to be there for you and also retain my own autonomy and have my own choices about things. And so just one thing I would say is that I've seen people get very rigid with this. Like my spouse doesn't get to tell me what I consume, whether, you know, which movies I see or what I drink or, you know, whatever. You do not get a say in this. I'm a grown person, right? You can be deeply caring about your spouse and retain your autonomy. What that might look like is, you know, I am realizing that at work, when I go do work functions, it has kind of kept me back socially to not be drinking, and I don't have a personal problem with that anymore. And so I would like to maybe have a drink when I go out with some friends from work. And then it becomes a question and getting curious about how that is going to affect your spouse, and saying, how do you feel about that? How does this affect you? What are your fears around this? And have a deep conversation in a way that is saying, I care about you. I want to know how this is affecting you. And I will take that deeply into consideration as I make my decision about what I want to do. It doesn't mean you give that all the authority to your spouse to give you permission. That often gets us into more of a parent-child role with our spouse, which is never healthy for a marriage. You want to retain that ability to be equals. So it becomes a negotiation, not a pleading for permission. Yeah,
we have a question. Should I just talk loud?
Come on up. Yeah, you need to come up.
So on this topic of considering the pain of the other, This is the worst time to talk about healthy boundaries when you're in pain, right? So there's the fear that comes up. As I'm kind of going through this process, I always find whenever there's fear, I've got work to do in myself before I can then come back to the table. But sometimes I don't have time to do that, right? Life is happening. Kids are sitting there. Home evening is coming up. Whatever the deadline happens to be, if that's the word. But it does sometimes feel like that, right? Where I don't have time to process as much as I think needs to happen in order to have, a healthy boundary discussion. So how do you navigate kind of in when the missiles are flying, right? What's the best way to kind of, I mean, I guess the answer, part of it might be, you know, go away and come back later and don't come back until you can do it. And maybe that's the answer, but then if that's the case, then how do you manage the day-to-day while you're still figuring out how to run things at home? Like, this is more of a manage your family question, I guess.
So I would say one of the first things is learning to be just aware of what's happening in the moment. When you feel yourself being in that space where it's like, this is important, I don't have time for this, just speaking how we feel is a really good skill to learn. And just to say, I am feeling really flooded right now. I am feeling really anxious. I don't know how to deal with this. I need some time to process. And I think an important thing to do in this is to actually set a time and set a time for and space for these kinds of conversations, because you also don't want to get into a pattern where you're escaping the hard stuff always and never coming back. And, you know, often one spouse needs to talk it through and the other one doesn't, you know, or needs more emotional space. So it's honoring to say, I need some emotional space to think this through. And how about we come back to this Saturday at 3? Or, you know, you set a time. I call it a bookmark. Let's bookmark this. And then set time aside later.
One suggestion is honoring that systemic integrity is sometimes when one couple is going through some big changes and trying to really figure out how they feel about certain activities or certain family moments, leaving it as status quo until you can have those deep, meaningful conversations to come up with a plan can be helpful because it creates some form of equilibrium. Another idea is recognizing when it didn't go well, even just having a follow-up conversation and be like, that didn't go well. I'm not ready to talk about it. I don't know what that meant for me. Could we create a time to talk about that later, right? Or we're going to talk about it with Anita, our therapist, about this next week, right? Like, it's really recognizing also what we need in the moment. So even asking our partner, is there a space to compromise? Even if it's just in the, you know, I need probably more specifics to help you. So in the question section, if that's not enough for you, come back and let's process a little bit more specifics.
Our experience is that it's usually not healthy to try to navigate those things when it's an emotionally charged situation. So it needs to be kind of decharged before you can really address those things. Otherwise, it's too easy to wound each other. I'd also mention that we didn't put it in the presentation here, but there are a lot of really great resources, and one of the best with regard to this is Dr. Christy Money, Christy with a K, has a website, and on the website under courses and materials, she has a PDF that's downloadable on navigating mixed faith marriages, and she provides a construct of how to go through and address a whole bunch of different issues that so that you're not just like putting out fires, but you actually have some sort of a format to go through and to discuss different issues that might come up as well.
One last point is when the pain shows up consistently and continually, right? Like wounding. So when Matt's like, pretty sure you can't yell at me about Joseph Smith, Sarah. Like right where the wounding continues to come up, that's probably where there needs to be a healthier boundary. Like, yep, probably can't talk to Matt about my feelings about Joseph Smith. Or, Sarah, this has never gone well. I am not him. We're not going to talk about this right now, right? Like that, when the wounding continues to show up, that is our entry level of healthier boundaries need to be created.
This is just a, I'll just go through this quickly. This is just one formula for approaching some really difficult conversations. So set yourself up for success, you know, figure out when is not the time when everyone's trying to run off to do 50 million things, but find a time and get permission from your partner. Is this a good time for you? Don't just throw something on them like, I'm ready to talk, and assume that they are. So set up a good time that would be good for you. Take ownership. So this is one of the biggest, hardest things to do, because when we're in pain, we all tend to project, and we just we make assumptions about what the other person is thinking, and then we run off of those assumptions, and all of a sudden we're having a conversation about something that wasn't even about what we were bringing to the table. So one of the most important things that we can do is separate the data from our stories that we're telling ourselves about the data. And I actually recommend using this language. You know, when you bring up Joseph Smith, what I tell myself is that you think, you know, you're saying something, but I don't know, that was a bad example.
No, that's right, that you agree with everything he ever did.
Oh, yeah, that you agree with everything he ever did, that you're judging me for how I feel about it, that you think I'm evil because I have this feeling about Joseph Smith, Those are the stories I tell myself. That way you don't get sidetracked. You're less likely to get sidetracked into the other person defending everything that they thought, because you are taking responsibility that this is how you are interpreting it. And then share emotions. I mean, this is really, you cannot go wrong. You can go wrong trying to argue over Joseph Smith. You know, that doesn't lead people to very good places. But if you say, I am feeling really sad about this, or I am feeling really ostracized because of this, or I am feeling this way, it opens the door to understanding rather than more argument, right? So stick to your emotions, identify what your emotions are, and share them. And then if you need a boundary, this is one of those places where if you've recognized that you need something, now you get to ask that and ask for it clearly and lovingly, and understand that you're not in control about whether your spouse will be willing or able to do that, and you need to give them the ability to have a reaction about what you're saying, the ability to be upset or confused or whatever their reaction is about what you're asking for. And they get their free agency to tell you how they can handle it, and you need to know what you're going to do with that. So you need to just try to be unattached and just recognize that they may not be able to give you what it is you're asking for.
My experience and what I've noticed in trying to support other people online and in person is that often the most emotionally charged conversations are when you're talking about the weeds of the issues. You know, Lorenzo Snow at 57 years old marrying a 15-year-old girl and having children with her. Like, that is not going to be a productive discussion if you're emotionally charged or angry. So it usually is best to stay out of the weeds and talk about, this is my experience, or it's painful for me, or whatnot, because that's something that's more easily processed.
I agree. And then also your language around it, because sometimes the weeds come up and you want to be understood. But to say for me, allow your spouse to have their interpretation and allow it to be valid. So for me, the church is true. For me, you know, and or for me, the church is a controlling cult, you know, is a little different than the church is a cult. You know, that is going to just make everything explode. Or if you're, you know, testifying to your spouse, right? It doesn't go well. But if you say, for me, this is how I'm experiencing it, we know that we're just trying to get understanding rather than make a statement and an argument and I'm trying to convince you.
Okay.
Well, start with validation. Yeah. So how can you help improve your relationships? So these are just some tips that we've come up with. I wish I could, I mean, if I could just choose one from this entire list and just put the whole slide on this, it's validation. Validation is huge. And sometimes we avoid validating because we fear that if I validate my spouse in their doubts, that's just going to encourage them. And they're going to go even farther away. And they're going to have all other kinds of questions. And rather counterintuitively, when you validate, it helps them lean in and feel safe. And when you're not validated, it can send people actually even farther down the rabbit hole. So, and you don't have to agree to validate. You don't have to agree. So what that might look like is just repeating what they said. So what you're saying is that you have a problem with the way Joseph Smith did that. I didn't have to agree, but they feel heard. You know, when you repeat back, they know they feel heard. You can also say, and this is one of the greatest gifts. I will just give a shout out to my husband. Through this whole thing, all of my questions, he has been my person. I throw everything out to him. And one of the greatest gifts he's given me is to be able to validate me. He's actually very good at this. He's much better than I am. In this realm, he will just say to me, well, I can totally understand why that bothers you. Like, that makes sense. And just that makes sense. He doesn't agree with me, and I know he doesn't agree with me on a lot of things, but he validates that I'm not insane. I'm not crazy. I'm not evil. I can understand why that would disturb you. And once in a while, he's even thrown out, wow, that's disturbing. He's allowed himself to go, yeah, that's disturbing. That's been a great gift to me along the way.
But at the same time, I can validate as as the unbelieving spouse, that my wife experiences divinity and beauty and growth and community in her participation, right? And I can celebrate and validate that beauty and experience, even if it would be painful for me to try to do the same thing.
Okay, just don't assume. Always just try to view through love. That is really hard to do when you're in pain. But in your better moments, when you can take a deep breath, remember you can always apologize. You can always own things. It's hard to do in the moment. We've all been there. We're all wounding one another, but we can always kind of take a deep breath, access God's love, the love of the divine, and come back and apologize and make amends. Show genuine interest, actual really deep curiosity about what that experience is. Again, when we talked about sameness and we don't do differentiation, we don't really know where, you know, sometimes we assume if we're the faith transitioned, well, I know what you think. I don't need to listen to you because I've been there. You haven't been there. So get curious about your believing spouse. Get curious about how they feel about things.
A really concrete example of that is, tell me what you get from your church experience. Tell me what feeds your soul, right? Like, so if you have a believing spouse, explain to me what the church is giving you, right? Like, it's like getting curious, just how you're hoping that they'll get curious with you about, explain to me why that's hard, or, right? Like, we have to model, and that's one of the things, we have to model how we want to be treated.
We've talked about sticking to feelings rather than issues. Be willing to give the benefit of the doubt. Recognize that when we're in pain and when we're asking all those questions, will I still be loved? Will I, you know, there's some fear around that. And we can also project those fears on other people. And so we can just, again, assume the worst about what they're thinking of you, or assume the worst of how, you know, yeah, how they're feeling about you. So be willing to give the benefit of the doubt. Be willing to be open to, you know what, this person really does love me. They're not out to get me. You know, they're just processing their own pain. Use respectful language. Be willing to communicate. Don't assume they know what you're feeling either. You know, you do need to tell them. Sometimes we really just want people to be able to give us what we need, and we think it's love if they just know how to do it. But actually communicating it and letting them know is a great gift, because we don't always know how to care for one another. Focus on what you have in common. Sometimes this can become the biggest thing in your marriage. Like, we don't agree on anything, because all you're ever talking about are the things you disagree on. But if you really sat down and wrote down the things that you value and believe, and the things that your spouse valued and believed, I mean, go do this. Seriously, I challenge you to go do this and write down all of your values and then bring your lists together, and you will be shocked at what you still have in common. So what can you actually do to build you know, activities and things, and for your families, around what your common values are? Because by and large, values remain the same through a faith crisis.
Also, the things that haven't changed, like, still love the kids, still really love going to sushi, you know, like, still love watching that show with you. I mean, like, sometimes we feel so ungrounded in our faith crisis experience, we forget the things that are still there and that have not moved.
Totally. Another example of that is, you know, you don't want to pay tithing. Well, you're not generous anymore. Well, maybe you're both still generous, and maybe we can find a new way to do evidence that together. So, yeah, and again, as Sarah said, model how you want to be treated. If you want someone to trust your faith journey, you need to trust theirs as well. You need to be willing to offer that back.
I have never seen proselyting go well, just so you know. From either sides of the coin, right? Like, just try harder, believe more, read your scriptures. Never seen that be successful. Or, you just don't know. You need to read this. How do you get your head out of the sand? Never once have I ever seen that heal relationships.
I've also never seen it work for someone to send someone an Ensign article and say, I was thinking about you. Or sending the CES letter to your believing family going, yeah, guys, here's something you need to know. You know, these things do not work. Do not ever proselyte. And, you know, there are some relationships where people actually do want to share some of this stuff. Tread very, very, very carefully and take the word proselyte out of it. This is an exercise in listening and understanding one another, not trying to convince someone of something.
And this is not to shame. We've been trained to proselyte. This is a cultural narrative. We have a lot of fear about our family members making different choices, right? Like our need to show up and teach whatever we've been trained to teach. Like that's a part of Mormonism, right? And you've probably done it. Your spouse probably has done it in different ways. And it still shows up on the reverse side. Everyone's proselyting what they believe to be the right choice for them. So I just want to make sure we're really gentle about that, because I see a lot of wounding between family members, especially like fathers and children and partners too. Hey, what can you do for yourself? We have no control over someone else's behavior or how our partner chooses to show up in our marriage. We do have control over how we take care of ourselves. And so self-care is very important. So is making sure you're getting support, professional and non-professional. We need to really understand the grief cycle. I can't tell you more, a faith crisis is pretty similar to the grieving process. So the more we understand grieving, the more we'll understand our own journey. And it's cyclical. Mindfulness and meditation have been really helpful, once again, bringing us back into the present. Being calm and cool enough to understand big feelings in both ourselves and our partners, creating our own safe spaces. And unfortunately, this may be outside of your family, and I think that's really hard when we have to recognize that. So keeping yourself safe is a priority. Modeling how you want to be treated, so being the bigger person, and I hate that, you guys. It is the hardest thing to do in marriages, but sometimes we have to be the bigger person. I'm making sure that we fall in love with questions more than answers. Can we really look at what our partner is asking us? Can we fall in love with asking more questions so we can practice that curiosity, which is an essential part of differentiation? Practice both and thinking, meaning making sure that we're using I love you and the church is really important to me. I love you and the church is a really big struggle for me right now, right? Like making sure that it's not just one or the other, that we're doing inclusive language. And continuing to practice our own internal authority, listening to ourselves and understanding what is or is not right for us.
Yeah, on the both end thinking, what I tell people is just try this for a day. Every time you think that you're going to say but, say and instead, and see how it changes the conversation you're in or the meaning of what's happening there.
So one of the best pieces of advice that I got early on from online support groups was to double and triple down my expressions of emotional intimacy to my spouse in her primary love languages, of course, so that she could be confident in my love for her and be able to distinguish our relationship and marriage from our sealing and our shared prior shared religious belief. And that made a big difference, because even when I was in significant amounts of pain as I was deconstructing, I really went out of my way, and my wife was able to notice that. But at the same time, there ended up being a big hole in our spiritual intimacy that I worked on, that we actually have a slide on that I'll talk about in a minute. I wanted to share this King Solomon analogy of prioritizing your love for your family member. In 1 Kings, there's the story of the two women who have infants, and one of the children dies. And so there's these two women are arguing over the remaining infant as to which one is actually the mother. And they go before King Solomon, and King Solomon says, well, this is easy. We'll just cut the baby in half, and you can each take half. And the one mother, who we often think of as the not actual mother, was okay with that. And then the other mother loved that child enough that she would be willing to have that child grow up in a home where they could live and thrive and be alive, right, instead of be dead. And the question is, in a mixed faith marriage, is if your spouse can't grow and be spiritually fulfilled in your spiritual home, do you love your spouse enough for them to grow up in a separate home? In a separate church outside of the church, or without a church, if that's what they need to grow and thrive.
Or remaining in the church as you step out.
Right, exactly, and vice versa. Do I love my wife enough that I want her to have those opportunities to thrive and be connected and experience the divinity and spirituality that she does in a tradition that's wounding for me now?
And that's the question we really have to ask ourselves. And this is why so oftentimes a mixed faith marriage is a gift, because it asks us to love at a whole new level. It asks us to show up at a whole new level, right? And we have to really ask ourselves, are we truly invested in the wellness of our loved one to the point where it challenges our ego, it challenges our reputation, it challenges our level of comfort, that we will say, I'm going to trust that you know what is healthy and well for you, and I'm going to figure out a way that I can help you spiritually thrive. So how can I mean, this is a question we never ask, right? But to our partner, how can I support you in spiritually and individually thriving? And that is a conversation we need to have cross party lines. Right? And then getting specific, like, these are the examples of how you can support me in spiritually or individually thriving. Like, I cannot stay in a classroom where they say something that is wounding to me and I'm going to leave, and I need you to support me in that. Or I'm not going to testimony meetings right now, too painful. Can't do it. I need you to know that and love me enough that even if you're a little bit lonely and that's awkward for you, for me not sitting there, that you're going to understand me enough. And if that's still, this is where we have to compromise, right, with the integrity of our relationships. But it's okay to recognize that we have different spiritual needs to thrive. And this is where we have to show up as our very best selves and ask ourselves, how are we going to love in incredible discomfort?
And then, especially at times when you are really deeply in the pain and you feel like you're having lots of conversations that are really, really difficult, it is really important to create a conflict-free zone once in a while, you know, have a date night and have the ground rule be, we don't get to talk about church at all. We're not going to talk about that at all. And you can connect back to the activities you enjoy doing together, or, you know, explore. This can also be a place where you can practice some of the differentiation. If you don't have the same hobbies, take turns planning something fun that you guys can do and get really curious about what your spouse enjoys about that thing.
If you sit in trauma nonstop, you're going to be traumatized, you guys. Right? So we have to create safe spaces within our marriage, even in the hardest moments.
So my wife and I shared significant spiritual intimacy as both active believing members of the church. But when my beliefs changed, there was this huge hole in our relationship. Even though I was expressing emotional intimacy in my wife's primary love languages, we were missing spiritual intimacy in our relationship. And so together we talked about what are the things that connect us spiritually, that give us an opportunity to have shared spirituality. And the conclusion that we came together for us is it's through service to others. And so two examples, early on, there was a young man, a 25-year-old young man, that committed suicide in our stake. And neither my wife and I were assigned to this family or whatnot, but we knew them indirectly, you know, and a little bit through girls' camp and so forth. So my wife went out of our way to go and sit with the mother of this 25-year, a single mother of this 25-year-old man who committed suicide, and mourn with her. And I used my skills as a financial planner to help take off the burden of dealing with financial matters, like figuring out what to do with the life insurance and the 401k, and how to have money set aside for this man's sister, the daughter in the relationship, so that she could go on a mission someday. And my wife and I went out of our way to spend time with the girl as well, with the sister as she was mourning. And my wife put together people to go together and clean the trailer home where the suicide happened, so that the mother didn't have to deal with that kind of a mess and so forth. It was an incredibly bonding experience to share mourning with those who mourn, right? The next thing that we've been working on recently is, when I was high priest group leader, there was a family in our ward that was living in this 1950s circa trailer that was falling apart, and the plumbing doesn't work, so they have to use a 5-gallon bucket in the kitchen, and there's no insulation in Billings, Montana, for the skirting around the trailer. It's just this disaster of a trailer. And when I was high priest group leader, we talked in the ward council about what could we do to potentially buy a replacement trailer home for this family, but we couldn't do it because it would be too big of a fast offering expenditure. It would have triggered an audit or something like that. And we really couldn't have the church do it because it would have set a precedent. Why them and not somebody else? So when we found out that the husband in this situation was in a nursing home with Alzheimer's on Medicaid, and it left the wife in her 60s and the 25-year-old disabled daughter in the trailer home, my wife and I decided that this is something that we're going to do together. And so we created a GoFundMe. We've raised $26,000 to buy a replacement trailer home for this family. And we've engaged people on the inside and outside of Mormonism. And it's given me an opportunity to reconnect with my friends and really close friends in the LDS community, to engage them in this effort and the spiritual experience of my wife and I going and visiting this woman and offering to her what we were wanting to do to get her permission to do it is something that is treasured for my wife and I. So I encourage people to seek ways to nourish and rekindle spiritual intimacy, because we can share those things. And whether it's service to others, or whether it's time in nature, or whether it's the beauty of music and other kinds of things, there are things that you experience spiritual connection in that you can share with your spouse and seek to nourish those things.
So as we all try to figure out common ground and common language for our relationships, one of the favorite definitions from all of us about spirituality is from Brené Brown. Spirituality is recognizing and celebrating that we're all inextricably connected to each other by a power greater than all of us, and that our connection to that power and to one another is grounded in love and compassion. Practicing spirituality brings a sense of perspective, meaning, and purpose to our lives. So if we can remember that, in essence, wherever we're practicing our spirituality or our internal sense of self, if spirituality is too triggering of a word, it's rooted in love and compassion. And so even if we're sitting in incredible difference, if we sit in that love and compassion, we are sitting in the root of what we believe.
So as we're navigating things, like in the five love languages, Gary Chapman talks about, it's important to state things as requests rather than demands. So it'd be like important for me to say, you need to come hold me as I'm waking up in the morning, you know, instead of a request or something saying, I really like it when you hold me when I'm waking up in the morning. Like, there's a big difference between a request and a demand. And it's similar when we're navigating territory in a mixed faith relationship. When we push people, their natural response is to push back. But when we offer someone a hand, then it's a choice for them to take your hand and move forward.
I want to give concrete examples. Like, I'd really like to invite you to my talk. I'd really like to invite you to come to Sunstone Symposium with me for a class, right? Like, it's an invitation. I'd love for you to be able to come to the Kids Young Women's Medallion Award, if that's safe for you, right? Like, it's an invitation. It's like, not, you got to be there. Like, it's a very different energy. It's a very different response across wherever you find yourself in that spectrum.
So the canoe analogy gets used a lot. So imagine that this is a family on a canoe and they're out going along, and one parent's at the front of the canoe and they see an alligator in the water, and they stand up and they're shouting and they're screaming and they're saying, there's an alligator in the water, we need to do something. And the spouse that's in the back of the canoe can't even hear what you're doing. All they know is that you're shaking the canoe and you're just about to capsize it. So what they tend to do is retrench, because they don't want the family to drown and they want to stabilize the canoe. And there's not going to be productive conversation when one spouse is perceiving that the other spouse is about to drown the whole family, right? So we need to calm down and stop shouting about the alligator in the water, and then we can have more productive conversations, and there's less likelihood to retrench and then not listen to each other.
These are some of our favorite resources. Anthony also has a large resource list on his blog, which we'll show you next. I'm happy to also send this PowerPoint to individuals if you give me their email address after. So we don't want to spend a lot of time here just because we want to make sure we have time for questions. One of our recent favorites is by Natasha Helfer Parker called One Family, Two Views. It's very skill-based, so it could really be helpful and useful. Some other ones, non-religious-based, are Nonviolent Communication, The Seven Principles of Making a Marriage Work by Gottman, When Mormons Doubt by John Ogden is a very safe and really healthy introduction to wherever you are on the spectrum about doubt in a non-threatening way. There's a Facebook group for mixed faith marriages for online support. Symmetry Solutions is where Jan and I work. We work closely with mixed faith marriages, even though we're all in them. And Mormon Mental Health Association has a panel of providers who are trained in understanding this with no prescribed narrative on what your path should look like, so it could be a healthy option. So please keep in touch and keep in contact, but we'd like to create some space for question and answers.
If you have a question.
I do have these two books up here of Natasha's, just so you know, signed copies if anyone's interested after.
Thank you, three. Appreciate that. Yeah. We have 20 minutes now available for some discussion or questions and answers that you may have for the panelists. You can address them individually to Anthony, Jana, or Sarah, and you can all respond together or individually. But please come and take your microphone so we can. I think I'm going to try to raise this up here so we can.
I'm lucky enough to know two of the three panelists here. So I'm Sarah's father-in-law, Steve Zabawa. We are all on a journey trying to get back to our Heavenly Father. Kind of a basic premise of this discussion today. And Gary Lithgow, LifeWorks, told me something one day that. Between my husband and my wife, or in this case, my wife, we're all trying to get back, and we have basically a ladder that we're trying to climb to get back to our Heavenly Father. And in this case, when you put two people together to try to do it together, right, you got two different ladders, but we got the same end point, which is getting back to Heavenly Father. And what Gary was just trying to point out is that the couple that you think's got the perfect marriage that's up in the front part of the pew, that's 80 years old, that are holding hands, and they've done it together after 60 years, you know, if you go ask them how they walked up the ladder, they would tell you that they started at different levels when they went up the ladder, when they got married, and that both of them at different times had fell off the ladder as they're trying to get back there, and that they needed to help each other get back on the ladder, and then take those steps one step at a time to build. As you take each step together, a lot of good things happen. So we're all trying to get up there, and if we all can remember that a lot of times we're thinking, right now we're all in, good things are going on, and we're both doing it together and so forth, and it feels great when you are. But when someone else is not getting there, it's our job to help the other one get up the ladder, I guess is the point. And we want to, at the end result is to be together, you know, together.
So can I ask a question?
Sure.
How does that work for someone who that is not their goal?
Well,
that they don't view their reality that way, maybe.
Well, everybody has free agency, you know, so it's that simple as far as that answer. But at the end of the day, is there a Heavenly Father? Okay, so you have to probably establish that premise first. And then if there is one, and do you want to get back together? And normally most couples want to, if you actually ask, I don't care if it's a Catholic, Presbyterian, Lutheran, they all think that their marriage is eternal, or would like it to be. And so if that's the basic premise that we're trying to have an eternal marriage together, how do we help each other get back there together? Because as we do that, we build a lot of good bonding opportunities and moments, and that's what a Heavenly Father, I suspect, wants for us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. And I think it's really important in all of that to allow space for different people to have different narratives. So how can your spouse get really curious with you about how you view that and how what that looks like to go there together. And then how can you get curious with your spouse, perhaps, if that analogy, does it work for them? Does it not work for them? If it doesn't work for them, then what about that doesn't work for them? Can you get really curious about maybe they have a different way, maybe they have a different idea of what getting back to God means, or how we do that? What is their map? What's important to them in that? How might our analogy help the situation? How might it be holding things back in us coming together? That'd be my suggestion.
Yeah, sometimes we start out thinking what we know what the steps on the ladder are, and then they totally change on us. And then we have to trust other people in their experience if their ladder looks different than ours, you know, if we want to prioritize the relationship.
So even if two people believe in a higher power, right, like in wanting to get there, but the steps change regarding how safe those steps are. For example, temple attendance can be a really triggering experience for individuals in a faith transition and really triggering for the believing spouse, who that is a huge part of their spiritual practice, right? So that rung for one person is very important and wants to be held onto, where the other person, they don't want that on their ladder anymore because that's not a safe place for them to experience God. So I think what the question is, where can we find similar rungs on that ladder? So we can have commonality of, like, if we're going to get to God together, and that is a unified goal, because it cannot be a unified goal, and then there's different conversations. But if the conversation is like, how do we get to God together if there is a God, which takes faith and uncertainty, what would that look like in our marriage? Could we practice family connectivity? Is prayer safe to you? If it's not safe to you, could we do it in a different way? Is that love and compassion, right? So I think in a Mormon narrative, we have a very structured ladder on what gets us to God, right? We do, and a lot of those are in the Temple Recommend interviews. And they're very literal. And for a believing spouse, those are literal. And so when you have someone else in a different experience, and the ladders, the rungs start changing, right, to how we get to exaltation or how we meet our maker, the conversation then is, so your steps are different than mine now. Where is their commonality so we can be unified in those and getting to our higher power?
And in my wife and I's example, it was doing those things that are attributed to the teachings of Jesus, to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to visit the sick and the imprisoned, and those are rungs on our ladder that we share together, that we do together.
I have a spouse who's a non-believer, and I've been in and out of the church all my life. We've been married 51 years. And it's a lot of give and take or a lot of compromise. And so that's how we work it. I mean, he's a really great guy. He does a lot of service for other people. I mean, but he's just a non-believer. And so he still lets me go to church when I want to go to church. If I don't want to go to church, that's fine. We do something together on Sunday or the Sabbath day. So we connect that way. So anyway,
I love that. It's a really healthy example of differentiation and meeting each other where you are and supporting each other where you are. Thank you for sharing.
Sorry, I had to take notes for this. So when my husband and I were at, like, the worst part of our marriage, my husband was seeing a therapist independently, and she was an LDS therapist, and she told him to not compromise on his values. And I feel like that, when you first hear it, sounds like a really great thing. But then he was, like, not wanting to compromise at all, because Mormonism was his life. Like, all of his values are so important. He wasn't willing to compromise on anything. And this really came to a head when we brought up the tithing discussion. And, I stepped back and was willing to, like, I was willing to compromise where he wasn't, to kind of save things. But I feel like that is probably a boundary issue, or like when Mormonism is, like, so important, like that important part of your identity, like, how can you compromise on things and create boundaries when both of you have to agree on this boundary.
So there's this saying that gets shared a lot, that if we don't smell tobacco smoke on the clothes of the people in our sacrament meeting, we're not doing our job, right? Does that mean we've compromised our values by associating with and loving people that hold a different belief system or habit than we do? That's the question. And so that can be challenging and stretching in Mormonism, because if our value system is that if you're going to drink wine, a glass of wine with dinner, that means that, like, you're violating, you know, your covenants and our marriage won't be eternal or something like that. Like, that's a pretty tender conversation. And so the question is how are you defining your values? If the values are the values attributed to the teachings of Jesus, then they kind of get down to love God and love your neighbor. And there's quite a bit of tolerance. Tolerance is probably not the right word, but validation that there's a different experience for people and we just need to love them.
So one of the things I would say is, like you said, there's some truth in not asking people to violate their own integrity and values. There is something, you know, that is good in that. And how do we negotiate? That becomes the issue. And do I get to say what the values, I think we get to say what my values are for me, but I don't get to put those values on you. And I get to honor your values as well. And that's where negotiation comes in. That there are ways to negotiate this. So using tithing as an example, I mean, that's a deep value to the church. It does. And so, especially in a single income family. And so some of the ways that I've seen that handled is that we just split the income in half and you get to be charitable in the way you want to with this half of the money, that this percentage, and I get to pay my tithing to the church with my half. Or, you know, there are some ideas around that, and different people have done it different ways. So that would be an idea around that. Does that help? You have a follow-up?
Yeah, sorry. That was actually what I brought up with the whole tithing discussion, but proposing a 5% split was compromising for him, and he was all, I don't want to compromise on my values, and he saw that as, like, his responsibility to pay tithing for the family. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I had to compromise all the way, rather than both of us coming together mm-hmm. to compromise that way.
Right.
But that isn't a compromise.
Finish the story, though. When we asked him today, what did he say? When we asked him, what are you doing right now, what did he say?
Okay, so I was on a panel earlier, and my husband actually did come and participate. So I don't remember. Do you remember?
He says,
So I told him, well, if you want to pay tithing, well, I'm usually the one who pays all the bills and stuff, and I told him, if you want to pay tithing, then you need to do it. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't do it very often now, so he thinks that it's about 5% now, but I think that's more because he doesn't have, like, a schedule. I don't know if that was exactly his intent, but that's how it has turned out, just because the responsibility of him doing it himself.
Well, and some of this is sometimes framing. I mean, you can look at that as paying 5%, or you can look at that as paying 10% of my whole. And if I have my values and I get to do with my half, he's still paying 10%. He's not paying 5%.
So I would also add that my core value of integrity is what made me have to leave the church. And I couldn't compromise that value. I couldn't sit in a Sunday school and have something taught out of a manual that I knew was inaccurate without raising my hand and commenting, which would have wounded my wife and my friends. So how do you navigate that when we both have core values that we do not want to compromise, and that's actually what leads us out of orthodoxy?
I just also want to point out there's a difference between owning and having integrity and compromising in what's called stonewalling. Stonewalling is, I will not talk about this. I will not have a conversation about this. You cannot challenge me on this, right? It's like, I will not go there. Don't challenge me, right? Like, that's, there's, that is not compromise, and that is not sitting in integrity. That is shutting down a conversation. And tension, that's saying, I do not want to sit in this tension. I do not want to know what's important to you, and I'm not even comfortable sharing what's important to me. So we need to be really careful, because I think sometimes in therapy, when a therapist is encouraging, like, I want you to listen to your values and hold on to your values, that does not mean there's no ability to compromise or come to the table and sit in that tension and figure out how you can still be rooted in that core value of charity in a way that honors your integrity.
Yeah, this is where, this is a good example of where the both and comes in. How am I true to my values, and how do I hold deeply what is important to you? And it requires us getting curious, and it requires us deeply caring and also holding on to ourselves. And when we're both doing that, it opens a space for real negotiation.
And I think this ties into both Steve and your questions of, you know, if the goal is to be unified, either unified in this life or unified in the next life, getting really clear about what are your core values so those can be honored in your work and compromise together. Like, what are those? What does that look like? Does that look like being charitable? For some person, that's going to be tithing. Another person, that's going to be donating to their favorite charity, right? But they're still unified on that exact same moral value, even though how that feels safe in that person's body or in their relationship with the divine is very, very different.
If I could ask a question that gets down to brass tacks. I'm wondering what a sample conversation would look like when I am trying to initiate an uncomfortable conversation. You've all mentioned perhaps starting to drink alcohol, ceasing wearing the temple garment, you know, various things like that. I'm wondering if there is a way, or just an example way, to initiate the conversation. That seems to me to be very difficult. It takes a long time for me to work up to that. So if you could provide some type of example, that'd be great.
Sure. So pick a topic for me.
Garments.
Okay. Something I could say is, you know, to my spouse. So I have something I would like to talk to you about, something that's been on my mind, and I'm feeling a little nervous, actually, about bringing it up, because I care really deeply about our relationship. I care deeply about you. I know, I anticipate this may be a little difficult for both of us, so I'm feeling a little anxious, and I'm wondering if now is a good time for you to bring that up, and if not, might there be a good time that you would feel up to having a discussion that might be a little difficult.
Okay, is it okay if I ask, like, what it's about? Because now my anxiety's high, and I don't know what you're going to tell me, and I don't know if I want to know, so.
That's fair. Yeah, that's fair. So what I've been feeling is that I'm starting to feel a little anxious about wearing my temple garments. I'm having some really deep feelings about it. My feelings have changed around it the way I used to see it. And I have a number of reasons why that is making me uncomfortable that I would love to share with you. And I want to know how you feel about it. I know that this is, you know, that there's a great likelihood that this is going to, you're going to have feelings about this, and I want to know what those are, and I want to explore that together. So is now a good time for that, or would you like to do that another time?
Can I take a day to really think about how I feel about this before we could come together so I can be honest? How about 5 after Jimmy goes to karate?
It's a date.
It's a very, very healthy way of doing that. You're probably going to get it. What are you talking about? So
we can
start
do
that. With that.
Okay.
Maybe react that way and then
okay.
Take the rest of it.
What are you talking about? Where is this coming from? Right? All of those core things. Like, who the hell are you? I probably wouldn't have say hell. I would say, who are you?
Okay. So I'm noticing this is already becoming a difficult conversation, and I'm noticing that my heart rate going up right now. I'm really noticing that this is hard. So tell me about what's happening for you.
I'm pissed that, like, what are you doing, right? So if I'm really, if this is right, we usually aren't this mindful in the moment. But if I was being mindful, I would be, this is terrifying to me. Because then this means maybe you're not going to go to the temple with me again. And I have some really big feelings about not having a spouse that goes to the temple.
So what I'm hearing is that you are really fearful about our eternal marriage. That you are really fearful of what that means for us. That you care deeply about that. I feel that. I can feel that. Yeah, and this is serious. And above anything, I don't want to hurt you with this. I don't. That's not my intention. And I'm having some really deep feelings. And it would be so helpful to me if you could at least try to understand where I'm coming from. You know, and for me to know that you care, that this is hard for me, would be really helpful.
I want to jump in right here. Usually the other spouse is still really worked up, right? So a simple thing is, like, I can tell that we're not ready to have this conversation. I can tell you're really scared. I want you to know I'm here to reassure you that I love you. I'm going to need to have this conversation at some point, just so you know. If we need to wait a little bit, that's great. If we need some help having this conversation, we might need some. But I'm recognizing that right now would not be a successful time and space to have this conversation. Another way is if your partner, if there's a communication pattern that is just it's never gone well, and what we call it is toxic. Sometimes being creative, like, could you write it down? Like, could you present it in a letter or an email? Sometimes emails are pretty invasive because we're not ready for it. But I'm trying to think of, like, even asking your spouse, I really would like to share how I'm feeling about this. Would it be safer if you read it versus seeing me talk about it? Sometimes levels of reduced vulnerability, even though that's not what we want, can be safer in having our hardest conversations. I love the idea of being respectful. Like, I can tell this is really hard for you, and I want you to also know it's really hard for me. And you're experiencing loss in this moment, and I'm experiencing loss, and how can we be our best selves in having this conversation?
So Stephen Covey, in his 7 Habits of Highly Effective Family, talks about expressing things on a scale of 1 to 10 as to how important something is, so that arguments aren't about winning, but we can express how. So here's how, as a linear thinker, this is how mine would go down. It would be, sweetheart, after studying the history behind the temple and where things came from and so forth, it's become very triggering and wounding for me. And wearing garments reminds me of that, and it hurts me. And so it's like a 7 to me that I stop wearing them. But I appreciate that could be very difficult for you, because it might mean something different than you for me. And so, if you can tell me what your number is now, that's great. Or if you want some time to tell me what your number is, and if your number's more than a 7, then I'll wear them. And if it's not a 7, then it would mean a lot to me if I could stop experiencing that wounding.
On that garment topic, this is something I'm right in the middle of right now. It was, 2 weeks ago. I had this conversation with my husband. Things had kind of reached a head where wearing the garment was feeling very painful to me. And I told my husband how hard of a time I was having with it. We had a good conversation where we were sitting, we were holding hands, we were really listening to each other and being respectful of each other. But my husband was telling me about how painful it would be for him for me to stop wearing it. And I would say what he expressed was his discomfort level would be like an 8 or a 9 if I were to stop wearing it, because he would take it as me no longer valuing our marriage covenant. And he would take it as a symbol of him starting to lose me, that it would just be a matter of time before I would want to leave the marriage too. And we both still believe in God. We both still believe in Jesus Christ. And he sees it as a symbol of Christ and the atonement and that shared belief. And so he sees it as me rejecting Christ as well as our marriage and having that be the first step to leaving him. And so out of respect for how much it meant to him, I told him, okay, I'll continue to wear it. But now for me, it's getting to a point of feeling like a feeling even more painful and feeling like having my husband's love is becoming conditional on being wrapped up in something that's become symbolic to me of the pain. And so I guess my question is, how do we find a good balance when both spouses have a pain level that's like really, really high, and still honor both in a situation like that?
Really, really hard question. And you know what? It's a really important question. And thank you for your vulnerability in sharing that. So what I would say is, first of all, just because you negotiate this one time does not mean you're not going to renegotiate this 50 times. Sometimes we want that one hard conversation to be the last hard conversation. But I think we need to kind of recognize that everybody changes. And we need to renegotiate and then renegotiate. And we need to leave space for it. Let's try this, and if it's not working for you or for me, let's come back together. So that's one thing. The second thing is, in that example, in that situation, rather than what you're discussing is the garment, but what's really under that is it's a symbol of something much deeper, and that's where the conversation needs to be. So how can we have a conversation about my commitment level? And is there something outside the garment that could help you feel like I am still committed to you? Let's explore some ways. Maybe we can even come up with our own symbol that I don't have to be wrapped up in my body and being harmed all day. You know, and you can express, I really wanted to do this for you because I love you and I do have that commitment to you. And I really wanted to, and I'm in so much pain right now. And I want to honor that, and I want to show you that I'm here, and I'm not going anywhere. And I need to talk about this again. You know? And then keep the conversation on, okay, what are your fears? Let's address them, and let's get creative. Are there new ways that we can do this?
I also think sometimes we have to make self-preserving decisions that are uncomfortable for our spouse, and we can do that in the most loving ways possible. And most of the time when we make those decisions, for example, if that's a sabbatical from church, which might be the person's biggest fear, but was essential for your own wellness, also you continuing to be your very best self in that marriage does internally reduce the fear of their primal fear of losing commitment. So sometimes we do, even though we extend that offer and we extend that compromise and it gets to the point where we do have to take care of ourselves in the very best ways possible. And that might mean taking off the garment for you if it's causing emotional distress. But then making sure that your behavior and your actions continue to desensitize that fear of there's no lack of commitment. There's no challenge in our relationship here. And I realize it's so different and unique to each person. But there are times where you have to prioritize your own wellness, but also circling back and reassuring that person over and over again. Like, I love you. I'm not going anywhere. I'm having to take care of myself, and I know that's so uncomfortable. I see your pain. I see your discomfort. But I have to do this for myself, and I'm going to do my very best to compromise in other ways. But there is that balance. Sometimes we do have to have the conversation over again, figure out if there's another symbol or another way that we can honor that person's primal need, while also recognizing we fundamentally do have to take care of ourselves in the kindest ways possible. So it's going to be a balance, Jennifer, and I don't know the answer.
I think we're out of time, but we'll stay after a little bit if you'd like.
That's what I want, okay. Because my situation is different, but it'll. I want to thank you for what, but I want to talk to all three of you.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry, I let it go a little over.
You enjoyed it so much that we went over.
No one's waiting at the door either, but we'd like to thank Sarah, Jana, and Anthony. Please give them a hand.